There is nothing fun about lying awake at 3 a.m. But what if instead of fighting it, you tried to embrace sleeplessness? Writer Marina Benjamin did and wound up writing one of the most lyrical books about insomnia I've ever read. It begins like this. When I am up at night, the world takes on a different hue. It is quieter and closer, and there are textures of the dark I have begun paying attention to. I register the thickening, sense-dulling darkness that hangs velvety as a pall over deep night, and the green-black tincture you get when moisture charges the atmosphere with static, and the gently shifting penumbra that heralds dawn. In sleeplessness, I have come to understand that there is a taxonomy of darkness to uncover, and with it, a nocturnal literacy we can acquire. Nocturnal literacy. I love that notion. Tell me more. What is it to you?
Well, I suppose it began for me, spending so much time awake at night, I began to pay attention to my environment a bit more. So part of the nocturnal literacy that I'm referring to is an acquaintance with the sounds and the feel of the night and the animals that are nocturnal who are awake when you are, the blue light from my computer, the kind of muzzy light from the streetlights, the noises of the night, thinking about who's awake at night, bin men, bakers, police, the sirens blaring. I suppose it's because I'm in an urban landscape, it's the urban soundscape that is my nocturnal reality, but I imagine it's very different for people who live in the countryside.
Well, I love the idea of paying such close attention because one thing reading your book taught me is there are so many kinds of insomnia. It began to seem sort of ridiculous to me that we have just this blanket term, insomnia, for an experience that can be so varied. So what's your personal relationship with insomnia? How long have you had it?
Well, I've known it all my life, really, but it's changed over time. I think many people will recognize what I experienced in childhood if I say that my childhood sleeplessness was much more a fear and a refusal of sleep than an inability to sleep. I just didn't want my consciousness to be blanked out by the dark.
Were you afraid of nightmares?
It was more that I wanted the day to continue, that I wanted the adventures and the play and the activity and the brightness of day and consciousness never to go away.
But then that changed?
Yeah. It became an inability to sleep. It felt more constitutional. I felt more defeated by an inability to sleep.
You know, when I have insomnia, and you know, we're talking about a middle-aged person's insomnia, it usually means lying awake, obsessively worrying.
Yes.
My mind feels like a gerbil on a wheel. I'm just kind of racing through this rather boring litany of anxieties over and over again.
I think at one point I refer to it as a kind of drip, 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 like waterboarding your mind.
Yes, exactly.
With an endless surplus of excessive and irrelevant thinking.
Yeah, as though you're trapped in the dark with yourself.
Absolutely. You are, because you have to confront yourself in insomnia, you are never more present than when you are awake at night. And actually, the opposite for the sleeping person is they are never more absent. They are a husk, a shell.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating paradox. This thing that we long for, right? We love and long for sleep, and yet we can't ever experience it. You can't witness your own sleep. So what is this thing that we long for?
Oblivion. Release from our own minds. From the tyranny of consciousness.
Yeah. You have this passage when you talk about sleep and love. What do you write? When you cannot get sleep, you fall in love with sleep. And I was thinking about how much we long for it and how there is something almost rapturous, kind of voluptuous about getting into bed at the end of a really long day when you're exhausted.
Every insomniac I know fantasizes about beds, about being horizontal, about rest. One friend of mine, when she can't sleep at night, looks at what I call soft furnishings porn. endless pictures of beautifully made up beds with fantastic bedspreads and swags of material and goose down feathers. And it's that ineffable link, really, between lacking and longing. When you don't have something, the more you don't have it, the more you want it.
Does looking at the pictures of beautiful beds help her fall asleep?
It does for her. It does it for her.
I'll have to try that next time. That makes me think about enchanted sleep. It's something else you write about, because those sound like fairy tale beds. I was surprised how many fairy tales do have some kind of enchanted sleep in them.
Although in many fairy tales, the sleep is cursed. Rather than a kind of restful sleep, it's a sleep of the dead.
Oh, that's right. Sleeping Beauty, for instance. She pricks her finger on the spindle and falls into the 100 years sleep.
That's right. It's very interesting how that association between sleep and beautiful women as well was another thing that interested me, this idea of this kind of enchanted, but in fact, supremely passive sleep. The more I read about it, the more I thought enchanted sleep was a kind of con, especially for women, a sort of enforced passivity, a negation of their actual agency. And I started exploring kind of the prevalence, particularly in the 19th century painting and 19th century thinking, of what the sleeping woman symbolized. The Pre-Raphaelites, for example, for about the second half of the 19th century, were endlessly painting sleeping women.
Well, that's interesting, because the 19th century was a time of social change and women were just beginning to emerge as more autonomous. A few more women began to have careers, for instance. Maybe this was a kind of subtle pushback.
Well, it's very interesting you raise this idea of kind of female agency and how it was viewed when women dared to kind of assert themselves in the public sphere or want a profession or want to write or paint or teach. If at any point they expressed the strain of having to fight their way into public life, they often develop nervous conditions, and these nervous conditions were treated by bed rest.
Something called the rest cure, right?
Yeah, the rest cure. So the American physician, Silas Weir Mitchell, started working with women who were showing stress from having their ambitions, their worldly ambitions, frustrated. And what he came up with was the rest cure. And the rest cure involved being put to bed, usually for a period of about 3 months. And they weren't allowed to do anything creative. They were absolutely not allowed to write or draw or communicate on the page.
Could you read?
I don't think they were allowed to read.
What did you do? Just lie in bed?
Yeah.
For 3 months?
Well, they were given a lot of insulin as well, so they slept a lot. And they were only allowed out of bed to relieve their bodily functions. And then they were put back to bed again.
That sounds terrible.
I know, it's enough to make you go crazy. And Charlotte Perkins Gilman practically did go crazy. And of course, she fictionalized the experience in her short story, The Yellow Wallpaper.
The famous one where this woman kind of feels like, well, she is going crazy.
That's right.
Weren't there other periods in history when people actually didn't expect to sleep 7 or 8 hours interrupted? I mean, you wrote about people like Dr. Johnson in the 18th century who had these very vibrant nocturnal lives.
Yeah, I think the injunction to sleep 8 hours a night is a product for capitalism. For capitalism to work, you need workers to be awake in the morning at their desks by 9 to do a full day's work, to go home, unwind, and then sleep. But in pre-modern times, and before society industrialized, it didn't really matter. And people would typically have 2 sleeps. So they would sleep as darkness fell, and then they would wake up in the early hours of the morning after a phase of 5 hours sleep, for example, and get on with their activities. And I use the example of Pepys because he kept a diary. So he'd get his hair cut, or he'd chat with friends, or his friend would sit in his bed with him and they'd share a glass of port, or he'd do astronomy.
So people were up and entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
They'd have friends over.
Well, he did. Yeah.
Have you ever tried that? Or has it ever occurred to you, maybe there's nothing wrong with your insomnia? Maybe your body's just trying to sleep in two chunks.
I absolutely do the 2 sleeps now, because I'm not the kind of insomniac who can lie in bed torturing themselves with their own thinking. You know, I get very bored with my own circular thoughts very quickly. So I do get up and I do stuff.
What do you do when you're up?
It varies. It depends how actually exhausted I am. You know, if I'm really, really tired, I'm not good for much. So I sit with the dog a lot. I might listen to music. I might scroll through Twitter. If I'm more awake, I might watch a documentary, I might do some writing, I might get my email, get a head start on my email for the next day.
It sounds like it can be a very fertile, creative time.
Yeah, I find it creative because of the intensity of being awake in the dark. You are in tune, not just to this kind of what I call the nocturnal literacy, this new landscape and soundscape of the night, but also you feel more porous in the night, not just to the external kind of stimuli, but also to your unconscious. So for creative people, I think it's really interesting when you're awake at night and there's less of a barrier between your unconscious and your conscious mind. Because I think a lot of creativity is about tapping into your unconscious mind. And we don't do that in the day because, you know, wakefulness drowns out the noise of the unconscious. And in sleep, the unconscious mind can speak to you.
There are times when coming awake at night, to me, feels like a gift. I know it can be really isolating, but there are nights when I surface out of a dream and it's this beautiful silent time when nobody wants anything from me. And if I can, sometimes I'll try to just go back into the dream. It's sort of conscious at first, but then it kind of merges into some almost twilight sleep state. I can't tell you if I'm dreaming or if I'm imagining. It's a bit of both. Do you ever do that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there are these, I don't know how to describe them really, sort of velvety states where you feel cocooned in wakefulness, as if you're sleeping, but actually you're awake. There are lots of states that are in between wakefulness and sleeping that we experience over the course of a night repeatedly. We don't always remember them, but we go through them, we cycle through them. So I think that there are these very interesting in-between states that we're often not witness to, just as we're not witness to our sleep.
Well, I was struck by your comment that in ancient times and ancient legends, people often went into darkness, sleep, to find truth or enlightenment. For instance, you talk about dream temples in ancient Egypt.
This was something I got very interested when I was reading about it, which is the idea of having a second sight or a third eye. And that vision, that insight, is actually predicated on darkness. And in Egypt, you would have this kind of temple sleep where you would open yourself up to the night and have these dreams, which were seen as prophetic gifts. So there's a long tradition of associating darkness with insight or deeper sight.
Do you do anything yourself to try to make the nighttime sacred time?
I mean, I don't do rituals like light candles or scents or, you know, make the night ritualized in that way. But I do feel the sort of magic of night when I'm in those quiet states of insomnia where I don't feel perturbed, but I feel kind of at one with the universe. And one of the things that I write about in my book, there's a running theme of cosmicity in it, where because there's nothing between you and the stars, you sort of only darkness, miles and miles of darkness, you somehow feel as if you can reach out and touch the stars. You feel connected. And I don't mean that in a kind of dippy New Age sense. I just mean that in a sense of it's part of the nocturnal literacy, really. It's part of the porousness. It's an openness to our sense of being, our animal natures, if you like.
You make me want to stay awake at night much more.
People have said that about reading my book. They've said, I want to be up at night. I'm jealous of your insomnia.
I'm going to set the alarm for 3 a.m.
I have a cup of coffee at midnight.
Marina Benjamin. Her meditation on sleeplessness is called Insomnia, and she was talking with us from her home in London.